I'm Cassie McCullough and welcome to Best of the Festivals on RN. All this week we're going to bring you authors who won major awards this year. We'll start with the big one, Tasmanian writer Richard Flanagan, who won the prestigious Man Booker for his novel The Narrow Road to the Deep North. He's also co-winner of the Prime Minister's Literary Award for Fiction and the winner of the Queensland Literary Award. It's a book that many of us might be reading this summer if we haven't done so already. Described by the judges as a masterpiece, it's the story of a Japanese prisoner of war camp on the Thai-Burma death railway. It's a love story too, and a very personal one for Richard Flanagan, whose father was a prisoner of war. Let's cross now to the stage at last year's Ubud Writers Festival to hear Richard Flanagan in conversation with RN's Michael Cathcart.
Richard Flanagan's powerful new novel is called The Narrow Road to the Deep North. It's the story of a young doctor named Dorrigo Evans and a whole cast of other Australians who experience appalling torments as prisoners of war, prisoners of the Japanese in the Second World War. So these men are POWs working on that murderous act of folly, the Burma Railway. Richard knows the realities of this story only too well. He grew up with them. His father was one of those POWs. Richard hails from Tasmania. He's one of the world's truly great and very distinctive writers in English, the author of Death of a River Guide, The Sound of One Hand Clapping, Gould's Book of Fish, The Unknown Terrorist, Wanting, and now this tough and, in some ways, well, in many ways, appalling story. Would you please welcome Richard Flanagan? We are in a very, very nice place. Should we describe this for the radio audience?
I think you should, Michael.
Well, we're sitting in a kind of pavilion, aren't we, above the Indus restaurant here in Ubud in Bali. And around us, as we look out of the windows, the open panels all around us, there is forest and palm trees. It's just, it's a bit like paradise.
It's a lovely place, yeah.
So let's... I thought you were the one with the way with words. Let's start this story at the beginning, the Burma Railway. I mean, I guess there may be someone listening today who's not that clear what the Burma Railway was. Just tell us so briefly what the Burma Railway was, the setting for your story.
The Burma Railway was one of the great war crimes of the Second World War, one of the great crimes against humanity, really, of the 20th century. It was built by the Japanese to link Thailand and Burma to supply their army in Burma for a possible invasion of India. And it was about 420 kilometres long, and a quarter of a million slave labourers worked on it, and an unrecorded number perished, somewhere, according to various estimates, between 100 and 200,000 people died. And most of those are completely forgotten, the Malay-Tamil labourers, the Thais, the Chinese, the Burmese, and so on. A small fraction of their number were Australian prisoners of war, and as you said at the beginning, my father was one of them. And I grew up with a man of strange anxieties and a deep compassion who this story became really the mountain that he'd climbed, and I guess in the lowlands of his life that followed, he was blessed with having a long enough life to be able to reflect upon it and come to a certain idea of humanity about it. And it was an idea of humanity that I wanted to reflect in a book that I wanted to be, above all, not a story of horror, but a love story.
Well, it is a love story, and we'll talk about how that works in a moment. Did you know any of his friends? Did he maintain social contact with other people who'd been POWs with him?
Yeah, my dad was very close to quite a few of the survivors. And as he grew older, he grew closer to them, and they to him. But there's no typical experience. There were also prisoners of war who came home and wanted nothing to do with their old colleagues. There were some that had a difficult contact. I think, for those who survived long enough and arrived in old age, those friendships became possibly the most, you know, outside of their families, the most important relationship they had, and perhaps in some ways more important.
So were you on a journey to discover who your father was? Is that ultimately what was driving you?
No, I don't think so. I simply understood that this was a book I had to write at some point if I was ever to keep on writing. It became something that nagged away at me. I tried to write it again and again. I really have been 12 years trying to write this book. I wrote it first as a novel of linked haiku. I wrote it as a haibun, which is a Japanese form of nature journal. I wrote it as a sort of Australian odyssey in the first person plural, where the prisoners of war are just represented as we, and that, you know, they on this journey to never arrive quite at the place they wish. I wrote it as a family epic, and each one of those books for various reasons failed, and in the end I burnt them. And then I realised my father was in his 90s, that he was growing old and frail. And I think why you write a book, why you do something, these things are unknown. But I realised I had to finish it, and it would be a book about love, written in the shadow of my father dying.
When you say you wrote all those books as failed versions of this and burnt them, do you mean that they were your next book? Have you been working on that as a series of drafts, or is this a project that extends back, you know, beyond the titles that we know, the titles that were published?
Yeah, no, I started this in the immediate wake of Gould's Book of Fish, which was published in 2001, and each draft was a complete novel, a finished novel. And each one didn't work. And you should know more about writing when you've written books, but the more I write, the less I know about writing, and the more unsuccessful I become. And really the only talent I've got is an awareness of my own mediocrity and knowing I should put the match to all the rubbish I write.
Cries of no, say not so from the audience. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart, and we're at the Ubud Writers and Readers Festival, which is a fabulous place to be. And I'm on the platform here with Richard Flanagan, and we're talking about his book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North. And despite what he says, it's an absolute corker. Why has it got this complicated title?
The title of the novel is also the title of one of the most famous books in Japanese literature, written by the great Japanese haiku poet Basho in the 17th century. And if that book is one of the high points of Japanese culture, I guess the experience of my father and his mates was one of its low points. And I have a great love for Japanese literature, and I wanted to use its forms, these forms of this exquisite and beautiful literature, to explore what was worst in Japanese history. Because I think within us all lurk both possibilities, one for absolute horror and one for creating transcendent beauty. And so the book is very indebted in all sorts of ways to the works of Japanese literature that I love.
Perhaps we can explain a little about how the book works. So the central character actually isn't a figure that equates to your father. The central figure is a man called Dorrigo Evans, who's a doctor. Tell us about him.
I was talking about characters with a writer here, a fellow writer here the other night, and I said in the end I think characters are not so important. I think any novel really is a cracked diary of your soul for the years you write it. And I think character and story are the sort of motley we throw over these otherwise incommunicable things that we carry deep within us, and we use them to create that bridge between ourselves and our readers. Character is a form of low cunning as far as a novelist is concerned, but I think also I never really think I fully know my characters, because they should be, as in life, a constant surprise to us. In brief outline, he's a young surgeon who ends up by accident as the leader of the prisoners of war in his camp, and he feels imprisoned by their belief and hope in him. And he comes because he feels that he's not worthy of it, that he doesn't have either the moral stature or the courage or the ability to offer them the hope they so desperately need. And yet every day he does it because he understands this is what is now expected of him by all these people who seemingly are actually under his command. And so I was interested in how all of us in different way assume burdens that we feel unequal to, and finally we become judged in a strange way by them. And this character after the war becomes celebrated as a war hero, and he feels a fraud and a fake about that because he's very aware of his own failings, and his own failings in being able to save his own men during that dark time. But to a certain point he also accepts that role because he feels it honours the dead and it gives the living some sense of worth and some sense of humanity having survived this horror. And so he does it. So he's a troubled character and one who's not reconciled to his own soul.
Now, one of the many impressive aspects of the book is not only the way in which you have stayed focused on the horror with this steady eye, both the realism and compassion, but also the way in which you've arranged the chronology of the book. So at one moment we'll be in the prison camp, seeing men enduring horror at its worst, or seeing men inflicting pain of the most cruel kind, and then we'll be in their younger lives, just before they went off to war, or we'll be in Dorigo's older life, seeing what happened to him afterwards. So the way in which you've arranged time is very complex. It folds back and on itself, it weaves backwards and forwards in a way that's totally engaging. Dorigo has, as you say, this is a love story. Dorigo is engaged to a nice girl named Ella, who's really suited to him. But before he's mobilised, he visits his uncle, Keith Mulvaney, who runs a pub called the King of Cornwall. We never learn why it's called the King of Cornwall. And he experiences a lightning bolt of attraction. Actually, he experiences that in a bookshop, but it goes on. He experiences this lightning bolt of attraction. Tell us about Amy.
Well, just before I tell you about Amy, I was interested in what you were saying about time, because I once, like you, Michael, was a historian, and I grew increasingly dissatisfied with the way time is understood by conventional records of history, that it's a railway station of thought and development.
And of cause and effect.
Yeah. And I loved about novels that they allow you to write about time in a way that I think is much more truthful to how we experience it. And I think what I've done in the book is not complex to understand, because it is how we all live our lives simultaneously in the past, in the present and in the future. There's a beautiful poem by the great Argentinian writer Borges where he writes, "Time is the river that sweeps me along, but I am that river. Time is the fire that consumes me, but I am that fire." And it's that sense, that circularity of time, which I think is a particularly strong idea in Australian culture, in Indigenous culture, and I think it's the way Australians particularly tell their stories in this circular fashion. It's that sense I wanted to have very strongly in this book.
Although no matter how circular your sense of time is, your personal journey does eventually come to an end. And there's a very powerful sense in this, in the closing chapters of the book, that all this circularity will finally straighten out and you'll come to the last goodbye.
It was at Flann O'Brien who said, "One beginning and one ending for a book is something I've never quite agreed with." And particularly not in that order. A story obeys strange rules of music, I think. And it is much closer to those mysterious rhythms that we live our lives in accordance with. And stories fail when they try to disobey those rules. What those rules are, I can't quite state. They are poetic, and you have to work hard to achieve them within a novel. But I don't think it's quite so straightforward as a beginning and an end.
No, but in the end, ultimately, the lives themselves have an end. I mean, I'm just reflecting on the way in which you deal with mortality in this book, because some of the men die young, most of them die young, in the prison camp, but some live to an old age, but finally even they succumb, as we all must succumb. So I suppose I'm saying to you that even though someone like Dorigo is experiencing his life as a circularity in which he can still be in love with a woman he was in love with as a young boy, a woman he can't have. Ultimately, you know, he knows that he will come to the end of his road, that he too will die. And that's a powerful idea in the book, people facing their own mortality.
I think great love stories always have death, because we understand that love, for all the sentimental tropes about it being eternal, we know that it's ephemeral. You know, it's Auden's faithless arms these night. It may be a moment, it may be a night, it may be a few years, very occasionally it's a lifetime, but we know in that love, that short time, we glimpse something eternal that is the universe, but we also know that it's going to die. That's the spiritual and psychological truth of love that we all know. When you write a story about love, that means somebody has to die to convey in story form that much deeper spiritual truth. And so in this novel, it seemed to me that war is the perfect counterbalance for love, because it is death. But love is this glimpse of hope. And really, to live is to hope. And a story that doesn't allow for that is untrue to what we know as life, because when we abandon hope, we cease to have a reason to exist.
The we tends to be men, doesn't it? This is a man's story, and it's about men who need love in order to have hope, isn't it? I mean, the women are the objects of their affections and desires and randiness.
Well, that's your reading of it, Michael.
Well, it's about men who suffered terrible torment, and about the way in which the thought that there was a girl waiting back home was a source of great comfort. And there's one character who's been carrying a photograph, not a photograph, a drawing made from a photograph of his girlfriend. And when he gets home and rings up, a man answers the phone.
What you learn when you write books is the person who knows least about it is the writer. That you start out with a few foolish ideas and strange aspirations, and somewhere in those long years of trying to craft and generally failing and finally producing a book, something happens, hopefully transcendent, and the book becomes unknown to you. And writers, I think, are somewhat autistic to their own creations, and if they weren't, they wouldn't need 120,000 words and all those years to create it. They'd be able to deliver a very neat aphorism here today to sum it up in 7 words. What's interesting about this book to me is that women read it very much in terms of the women characters and the love story, and men read it as a war story. Is it one or the other? It is what each reader discovers within it. I'm grateful that people find multiple things in it, because that's what life is, this strange chaos. A novel, unlike a history or journalism, is not an argument if it is successful. It is open to the inconsistency and chaos of the human heart in all its strangeness. And when I hear readers offering or telling me completely conflicting things, it's not that your take on it is untrue. It's just that other readers discover the contrary and then something else again, utterly peripheral to those points of view. And then I'm happy.
You're on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is Books and Arts Daily. We're in Bali together, and we're at the Ubud Writers and Readers Festival, and I'm on the platform with Richard Flanagan, who's trying not to answer the questions. Do you...
Have I succeeded yet, Michael?
Yes.
That's my question. You've been grievously pushing me. I have grown a little nervous, but...
Is there a part of you that would rather not do the writer's circuit? Is there a part of you that would rather just write the books and send them off in their voyage into the world and not have to bear witness to what you've done?
Well, when I was at the bar at 10 o'clock last night, no. But half an hour ago when we sat down in front of all these wonderful people, yes. Because I understand people wish to see and hear from the writer, and it's very far from the worst thing you can have in your life to be allowed to come to such a beautiful place to meet writers, to meet readers. There's a great joy in that. But I really find the more I write, I hope the more of me is in the book. And there's not much of me left to explain what the book is. And to be honest, I really don't know. There's a wonderful story come essay by F. Scott Fitzgerald called The Crack-Up. And in it, he talks about how with each story he wrote, he felt he became less, that he was being corroded out by what he wrote, that something was vanishing from his soul. And it is a terrifying idea, and it is the opposite idea of the conventional nostrums of career and success and so on, which is the idea that as we make things, we grow. Fitzgerald's idea is the inverse of this. And he writes of how, in the end, what you're left with is a small and mean-spirited man who sits in the at the corner of the bar, and that, he writes, is me. And I think you simply discover the more you write how strange novels are when they succeed, how strange art is. And all I've learnt to do is to seek to respect readers more and more and to write in a way that allows them to make the judgments and conclusions. And that manifests itself in strange ways. I said to my editor this time, adjectives are judgments. Take everyone out that's unnecessary. You know, anything that seems to be telling the reader what to think is an offence to the form of the novel.
It's a shame, then, that the title itself is so heavy on adjectives, isn't it? The Narrow Road to the Deep North.
That's the problem with plagiarism, I suppose, Michael, which is yet another of my many literary crimes. I mean, having said I had ambitions, I've also always been honest in my complete failure to realise any of them.
I'd like to talk to you, nevertheless, about the way in which you've represented the Japanese, or the way in which the Japanese are represented in this novel, which now has a life of its own.
I'm glad we're agreed on that.
Because quite seriously, it's an important leap forward in telling war stories that you also write about the enemy. So if we go back to that classic Australian film Gallipoli, for example, which has done so much to shape our sense of the way war is or what the experience of war is like, there's no sense of the Turks at all. They're just these people on the other side of the ridge. But in this book, you take us inside the life, you give an inner life to the Japanese. And I suppose the most powerful of these, the most enigmatic and captivating, is the commander of the railway project, who's a man called Nakamura, who's an engineer by training, used to living in the city, and suddenly he finds himself having to run this project out in the jungle, a project that is by its nature impossible, but which he seems quite proud to be in charge of. Can you talk to us about how he grew for you?
There's a wonderful story later made into a film, which I'm sure many people here and listening will know, Rashomon, in which a murderer's looked at the responsibility, the guilt, the shame, the evasions through the eyes of everyone who witnesses it. And it was that model that I wished to use with this novel, because it seemed to me then I could somehow find a way of speaking to the truth of these things. It's not a novelist's job to represent reality, but it is their job to try and get to human truths. I don't research that much. I had to do one of those dreadful side strips for some magazine, and they said, how did you research this novel? And I wrote, I lived. That was it. You have to seek to discover in yourself what it might be like to be a Japanese commander, to be a Korean guard, to be a homicidal Japanese colonel. But what I did do, finally, and not with great relish, I must confess, was go to Japan and to meet with some of the guards who were still alive. And I went there last December when the novel was in rough shape, and I knew roughly, what I wanted to do with all the characters and what the plot was and so on. And because the Death Railway was such a vast project, I didn't expect to meet anyone who had anything to do with my father. But I did. I met a health orderly who had gone to my father's camp and recalled the Australians as skeletons crawling around in the mud. This was quite a shocking idea to me, because I realised my father's memory had started to distill in a very powerful way what had happened to him, and that all the abhorrent details, all the details of horror, had slowly been lost to him, and he was finding within this story a notion of human goodness that would transcend it and would make some sense of it. And then to be confronted with this other account from the other side that was so horrifying was very difficult for me. And then I was in a train going to a taxi office in an outer Tokyo suburb. We were about 5 minutes from getting there, and I realised the guard we're going to meet was actually a guard known to the Australians as the Lizard, and he'd been a guard, he'd been the Ivan the Terrible of my father's camp, which was Weary Dunlop's camp. And the Australians had hated this guard above all, and after the war he'd been sentenced to death for war crimes and then had his sentence commuted to life imprisonment and finally was released in a general amnesty in 1956. And I knew the Lizard's story, but I had never expected to meet him. So I was taken into the taxi office and into a room where I met a gracious, gentle old man who was willing to answer my questions. And I didn't quite know how or what I should do, but I decided I must do what I was doing with all the others I met and not speak to them in any spirit of judgment or accusation, but simply try and find the small details of their lives and find in them something that would help me write this novel. And so he told me about growing up in Korea as he had, about the way he was sort of press-ganged into being a guard, the violence of his training. He said to me at one point something quite illuminating. He said, "I'm not Japanese or Korean. I'm a man of a colony. You have to understand." He was a man who had wielded this great power, who had this enormous sense of complete impotence about his own life. And I asked him to slap me because the Japanese army had this form of punishment called binta, where they slapped with the open hand. And they would do this for seemingly to the Australians for no reason. And he thought this was, odd, quite rightly, a rather ridiculous and strange request, but he was finally persuaded that I was genuine, and we stood up. I asked him to slap me a few times. They slapped both sides, each hand. And he slapped me with these those sort of peculiarly dry and papery old hands, but also with a strange force still. And waiting for the blow was still not a pleasant thing. And then after he had done this, and this is where fiction is never allowed to entertain the poetic strangeness of life, immediately after he'd done this, the room started to move sideways and up, and it started to sort of sway and rock, and things started falling off tables. And what had happened was a 7.3 Richter scale earthquake had hit Tokyo. And so there we were, me and the Lizard, the dreaded Lizard, in the middle of an earthquake in an outer suburban Tokyo taxi office. And he was terrified because I'd never been in an earthquake before, and I didn't realise what the consequences could mean. But it was a large quake, and on top of the normal problems with earthquakes since Fukushima, they're very frightened about what it might mean in terms of their power stations. So he's there frightened, and I realised wherever evil was, it wasn't in that room with me and this old man. When I got home to Australia, my father rang me, and he asked what had happened. I said how I'd met these various guards and that all of them had expressed shame and remorse, and all of them had said sorry, which they all did. They didn't exactly, I mean, I'd have to qualify that and say, I'm not sure if they felt guilt as such, because they felt their actions were sometimes beyond them. But there was something deeper than a guilt. There's a human shame about what had happened and their role in it. And they were genuine, I felt, in wanting to offer some atonement for that. And my father, who normally would have talked for some time, said he had to go and hung up. He was 98 by then. Having said his memory of the camps was being distilled, it was still very precise and his mind was very sharp. But later that day he lost all memory of the prisoner of war camps, and it did feel to me as though he were finally free of something.
You're with Best of the Festivals on RN, and this is Booker Prize winner Richard Flanagan with Michael Cathcart at the Ubud Writers' Festival talking about The Narrow Road to the Deep North.
You say that some of those guards you spoke to expressed regret or said they were sorry. I wonder when that feeling of regret set in, because one of the powerful closing sections of the book takes us into the period of the war trials in which these men are put on trial for crimes against humanity. Often it seems for quite minor things in their lives, you know, for slapping a prisoner, when we have seen them in your book commit atrocity after atrocity. And during that phase, most of the men you describe as they sit in prison are simply bewildered that they're on trial for these crimes against humanity, because, as you say, they were part of a machinery that was much greater than their individual will, or they say, I was doing it for the emperor.
There is a crime at the centre of this book, where a man is an Australian prisoner of war, is beaten to death in front of the assembled Australians, which is a story I grew up with when one of my father's best friends was beaten to death in front of the assembled prisoners for no real reason. And that arouses in people a strong desire, obviously, for justice and vengeance. And I wanted to write about the execution of someone who is actually guilty of that crime, because in the end, it's you can't but be left with a sense of hollowness. And it is the case with all these terrible crimes that very often it is the small fish at the bottom who pay with their lives. And the people of much greater consequence who don't have remorse escaped that justice. And that does seem to be very much the case with the Japanese military after World War II.
In fact, you say that the people who got away were officers who had connections with Japanese aristocracy.
That's right. The people who tended to swing, not always, but tended to be the lowly Koreans, the Formosans, as they were known, the Taiwanese. I should add an aspect to that. Having said these particular guards expressed remorse, they were the people who were willing to meet me. And it is a literary fiction that if you commit a crime at a certain point, you know, the body will rise back up in the swamp of your mind and haunt you. I don't think that's the case. I think it's possible for human beings to commit terrible crimes, live to an old age, and go to their deaths feeling that they are good men and just men, and that and to find complex ways of understanding and rationalising the crimes they've committed. And the terrible thing when you think about it is the way when societies start becoming evil, they persuade people to conflate an idea of their own personal goodness, which I think is strong in most human beings, with poisonous ideas of national purpose, national need, and so on. It made me think very much that we must always be very conscious when a nation starts telling us that some other group is less than human and persuading us that as good Japanese or good Australians, that there is another group whose lives are somehow less than ours. And I did think in the recent election when it was spoken about asylum seekers and whatever position people have on it, it is not good when a society has its leading politicians saying our policy is cruel but necessary. I think when you get to the end point of evil after 1945 and you wish to hang people, it's really the wrong moment for judgment and action, although judgment and action are necessary. But it is at the beginning of things when small stones are thrown that we should be vigilant and seek to call it and stop it before they turn into a mudslide that carries us all the way into something else. And it is possible for societies to make those choices, and societies often do and have the wisdom and the humanity to step back from those, you know, those small wrong decisions and call back those stones they've thrown.
You take us inside the head of Nakamura, the commander of the project, the commander of the Death Railway, and then his immediate commander, Kota, who's a man who just loves chopping men's heads off. He gets a thrill out of doing this. And you say that they had no idea what the Australians meant when the Australians talked about a society based on freedom.
Well, we have, I think, a really foolish notion in Western countries that progress delivers freedom. It is not the case that non-freedom can deliver progress too. Progress brings no necessary moral virtue. Some Western countries have been lucky that progress and democracy and freedom have arisen together. But it is not necessarily so. And there have been great achievements in human history that have been won at the consequence of non-freedom, and they are built on mounds of hundreds of thousands of corpses. And so it's very wrong to make a fetish of any sort of progress if the cost of any of it is a single human life. And so that was my point. And, the Japanese officer is making the point to the Australian doctor that there is an alternative to that idea, and it is a very powerful alternative, and it is an alternative that could possibly endure and triumph, and that there is nothing given or certain about this idea that progress and freedom come together. But I guess in a sense that the book is about notions of freedom and what freedom is, and because really I'm not left believing in much in my life, but I do believe human beings aspire for freedom. All living things aspire to be free, to be what they are, you know, bamboo to be bamboo, a man to be a man. And they have a longing for the truth. And when they hear it, they know it for what it is.
There's a really transcendent moment in the book where you show the jungle itself having that philosophy built into it. So years have passed, the line, as it's known, the railway, is returning to the jungle. And there's two or three pages of just wonderful writing of how it's all reverting. Can you talk to us about that moment?
There's a very famous Japanese haiku, which really that whole chapter is just a riff on, which talks about, it's translated various ways, but it's something like, dreams of imperial warriors, all that remains is long grass. And my chapter is a really waste too many words saying what that haiku says much better in far less words.
This is Books and Arts Daily. We're on RN, and we're talking to Richard Flanagan about his book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North. The novel is in some ways in dialogue with the ways in which we remember war, the official commemoration of war. And one of the heroes of the official account of the war is Weary Dunlop, this doctor who was the doctor in the camp where your father was. And Dorrigo Evans bears some similarities to Weary Dunlop, not entirely like Weary, but some similarities. He's a brave man in war who becomes reckless in peace. Weary was an active agent, I think, in the promotion of his own legend, whereas Dorrigo is more bewildered to find himself transformed into this kind of patriotic saint. Can you talk about that difference between the two? Because, you know, Weary Dunlop has become, with the passing of the years, a nationalist saint.
Well, as I said earlier, my father was one of Dunlop's thousand, that now near mythical group. And my father and all the survivors thought of him in the highest possible terms. The interesting thing about the Australian prisoner of war experience is that there were a number of other doctors who had the same stature in the camps. Rowley Richards, Ewan Collette, Kevin Fagan, to name but just a few. And it's intriguing that it was these men who became the leaders in the camp, and they all behaved in the same way as Weary Dunlop did, with extraordinary courage, with enormous capacity to hold their groups together. And there is within it, I think, our greatest war story, because it's not a story about force of arms, about martial achievement. It is a story about human beings discovering the best in each other, a compassion, a communality, and a capacity for forgiveness. So it is an extraordinary story. And in creating this character, I drew on all those different stories of the different doctors. Dorrigo Evans has got the early life of my father. He is one of those many famous doctors, and I can understand the parallels with Weary, but his post-war life is a complete invention. I met Weary, I had a night drinking with him once, and he was a truly extraordinary character. He was a man who, at one point in the camps, was sentenced to death to be beheaded the next morning, bundled into a tiny cell, and he spent the night reciting Keats' Ode to a Nightingale. Really, we invent God to explain the miraculous truth. People so extraordinary and multifaceted as that, with all their light and dark shades. But it has given to me, a novelist, the possibility of only inventing far more plausible lies in the form of a character like Dorrigo Evans.
Mm. Dorrigo's inspirational poet isn't Keats, it's Tennyson. It little profits that an idle king by this still hearth among these barren crags matched with an aged wife. I meet and dole unequal laws unto a savage race that hoard and sleep and feed and know not me.
Beautiful.
Can you talk to us about what that poem represents for him? Because it's Ulysses in his old age saying, come on, chaps, let's go off and give it one last shake. We'll go out to the edge of the wide world and, you know, call it a day.
Well, it is, I think, an extraordinary poem. And it is oddly a modern poem too. It's a poem of isolation, of loss, of yearning. And I wanted to have in the form of Dorrigo Evans, somebody who comes to conceive of their life increasingly in poetic terms, until in the end he finally becomes the embodiment of the poem, and he's no longer sure what his life was and what the poem is and where one ends and one begins. Because you do meet people who whose lives in the end take on those extraordinary forms. And so I guess I should add to this that my grandparents were illiterates. My father was a great reciter of poetry, had an extraordinary memory of it. And as he grew older, the quotes grew ever more apposite, and in the end he couldn't remember what the poems were or where they came from, and yet he always quoted them word perfectly. And I said to him, why is it that you love the written word so? And he said, because where I grew up, they were the first beautiful thing I ever knew. And I think there is, amongst people who come out of illiteracy, who know the enormous burden of not having access to the written word, there's also a sense of the liberating power and the magical alchemy of words, their capacity to transform a life, a world, and you with it. And it is that sense of language as still this most extraordinary human invention that creates us as much as we create it, that I wanted to have in this character of Dorrigo Evans. Life isn't progression, it's moments, you know, and often they're glacial periods in between. But there is, I think most people know these things in their teens when you achieve something physically that is astonishing, above all to yourself. And there is a profound joy. But with it, there's tinged, you do have in the back of your mind an awareness that this may never come again, that this, you've realised something, and it is glorious, but it may never come again. The simplest of sport can be a beautiful expression of everything that is wondrous in the soul.
Can we talk about one more poem? And that's the words, lest we forget. We're haunted by those words in Australia, lest we forget. Mm. And they always bring a tear to my eye when we hear them on Anzac Day. And you make a point about them, which is something I hadn't realised. They're by Keating, and they come from a poem which is about the inevitability of forgetting.
That's right. The poem is about how everything is forgotten. It's about how in the past there have been these great empires, and in the end, no one remembers any of their achievements, their struggles, their failures. And it is It happens in the novel in a point where there's an argument between Dorrigo Evans and a soldier about whether they should try and save this sketchbook of a cholera victim. And at the same time, Dorrigo Evans is trying to come to terms with the fact that he's been told that Amy, the girl you spoke about earlier, who he's in love with, he's discovered she's dead. And he realises that this extraordinary experience, because I think one of the things this book, it's about many forms of love, family love, the love of friends, but it's also about, you know, those extraordinary passionate loves. And those loves, friendships and those sort of forms of love sustain us, but those extraordinary loves between two people define us. And he understands that this is now going to be forgotten. He'll carry it until his death, but no one else will ever know because it's been an illicit love and it all will be forgotten.
That's a good place to end. Would you thank Richard Flanagan?
Richard Flanagan talking with RN's Michael Cathcart about his prize-winning novel, The Narrow Road to the Deep North. It was recorded live at the Ubud Writers Festival in Bali last year and first broadcast on Books and Arts Daily. Now let's hear some reading suggestions from two of our RN presenters. We asked them to nominate their best reads from 2014, and naturally, at least one of them was going to choose the book we've just been talking about. RN Best Reads.
Jonathan Green here from RN Sunday Extra, and look, someone had to do this one. And yes, Richard Flanagan won the Man Booker for The Narrow Road to the Deep North, so yes, obviously it's a darn good book. And anything I say, well, it's not much more than licking the spoon that someone else used to put the icing on the cake. Even so, gosh, but this is a good book. It's intricate, purposeful, careeringly ambitious. This is silly and coincidental, but when I first read the name of Flanagan's central character, Dorrigo Evans, the image of Patrick White's Hurtle Duffield popped into my mind, the troubled creative genius of the arguably autobiographical The Vivisector. There are parallels between the two books in strange ways, in their oblique references to actuality, in their complex wranglings with truth and meaning. Flanagan's too, a partial work of family biography. But really, this juxtaposition is entirely in my own mind, I know, but by small coincidence, The Vivisector was one of six books shortlisted in 2010 for the Lost Man Booker Prize of 1970. So there you are. The Narrow Road to the Deep North enters that pantheon of great Australian novels, probably on a slightly more accessible shelf than the various works of Patrick White, but there no less deservingly. It's a place earned not for simple storytelling, not for easy elegance of prose, but for the significance of the tale, for the deeper truths it teases out and reveals, and for the challenge the author sets, mounts, and then overcomes. There is, or there was for me, a moment about a quarter of the way into Flanagan's book when the various limbs of his tale are laid out, when the author's intention is made clear. In this case, to marry love, death, life, redemption, humanity, the burden of suffering. And it was a moment in the reading that stopped me in my tracks and made me wonder, wow, that's ambitious. If you pull this off, it's going to be quite a book. And he did. And it is.
Here's one from the man usually with you at this time.
Hi, it's Waleed Ali here for RN Drive. I've been thinking about what to tell you about the best reads of 2014. I have to begin with an honourable mention. I know it's not the convention, but I have to do it. And I want to give an honourable mention to Omar Moussa's book, because this is his debut novel, and it's rare that you find a debut novel that has the first chapter all in verse and a massive chunk of it, probably about a third, as a form of poetry. It represents the gritty emergence of an urban multicultural Australia that I just don't think we've seen represented in literature in Australia before. And so for that reason, I have to give him an honourable mention. But the winner in the Waleed Ali Award for the best read of 2014, it's very hard to top this guy. A man by the name of Chris Hadfield, who you probably know as the singing astronaut. He's the guy who sang David Bowie's Space Odyssey. and then put it on YouTube and then became, well, almost literally a rock star. He's written a book which was released this year, which is called An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. And then it goes on. What going into space taught me about ingenuity, determination, and being prepared for anything. This is a person who's achieved the most extraordinary things. I mean, he's been in the International Space Station. He's come back. He told me stories about how his skeleton still has to grow back after his escapades in space. And he just says it with this kind of deadpan normality. And that gives you a sense, really, of what the book is actually like. In some ways, it's a bit of a self-help book. I mean, he tells you all these stories about being in space. He tells you about the years of training and talks about the first time he ever went into space and how his face began to hurt because he'd been smiling so much. These are the kinds of stories that he tells. He gives you all of that kind of detail. So if you're interested in what it's like to be an astronaut, it's all there. But it's the understated, modest aspects of this book that are just so alarmingly striking. It's kind of self-help, but it's really, in my view, a kind of anti-self-help book. His best advice is stuff like, be competent. Don't make things worse. Don't visualize success. Start visualizing failure. Then you'll be absolutely ready for everything or for anything that may eventuate. He goes on and says all the things that you don't expect an astronaut of his fame to say. He says he's not a thrill seeker. He goes on and says, to me, the only good reason to take a risk is that there's a decent possibility of a reward that outweighs the hazard. I mean, what kind of thing is that for an astronaut to say? And yet, it's those very things, that kind of understated modesty, that groundedness, that thing that is the antithesis of the entire self-help genre that makes this such a compelling but also accessible and applicable read. You can actually apply the lessons of an astronaut to your life in a way that is really, really straightforward. And any astronaut that can pull that off in text, I think, deserves the gong of the best read for 2014, at least from me. Enjoy.
For more best reads, go to the RN homepage.
Tomorrow on Best of the Festivals, another Booker Prize winner. It's Eleanor Catton who won the prize for her book, a very long book, The Luminaries, set at the time of the New Zealand gold rushes in the 19th century. The Guardian called The Luminaries perfectly constructed as the consummate literary page-turner. Here's a preview.
They had been asking for the novel for some time, but the way that I work is that when I get to the end of the book that I'm writing, it's because it's finished. I don't draft. Yeah. And because this was colossally long and kind of much longer than I ever dreamed or indeed wanted it to be, really, certainly when I set out, it kind of felt as though this deadline was going further and further away from me as well, and I just kind of couldn't really do anything about it. And Grant was getting very, very anxious, and I later found out it was because they wanted to submit it for the Booker Prize, and they had a deadline, but they thankfully kept this from me, and I just thought they were being anxious for no reason, so I kind of kept on going off and watching whole seasons of Breaking Bad and this kind of thing, that they would then read about on Twitter and get extremely angry about, which is fair enough.
Eleanor Catton, the youngest ever Booker Prize winner. She won the prize last year for The Luminaries. That's tomorrow on Best of the Festivals. I'm Cassie McCullough. Enjoy your evening here on RN.